The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Good morning if you're just after joining us. It's good to have you all on board. Okay, let's get to some more of your comments. Good morning, Greg. Welcome. That's a few birthday requests. I'll get to them all together in a group. Hi, Greg. The increase in rent rates between new and existing renters mentioned on the news directly correlates with the difference between the maximum pay to citizens and residents on HAP and the rate paid to Ukrainians. A family of two adults and three children receives €520 per month on HAP and must contribute a minimum of €120 per month, total €640. At least Ukrainians receive €800 per month per property, regardless of whether it's a single person or a family. Our citizens and residents are being discriminated against and treated as second-class citizens by the state. Well, it is the owner of the property that receives the €800 per month, is it not? But that's not to dispute what you're saying. That's your view. Bottom line is though, the reason there is a difference between the new rents and the current rates is that people are on rents at the moment. It can be quite difficult for landlords to increase them. And any new properties coming to the market, or if they've managed to get the residents out, they are bumping up their rents much higher. It's got very expensive to rent in this country. Like, it is more than a lot of people's mortgages. Politicians flying to Dubai for COP. Did they ever hear of Zoom? Yet they preach to the rest of us about our carbon footprints, and therein lies the problem. That's how it feels. That's how people feel. Regarding the community work scheme, the people out cleaning the town, they earn €12 an hour. If these gentlemen and women are so valued, why are they only on €12? Why is nobody fighting for more money for these people? Well, if any of them are listening and want to make their case, we're a platform here for everyone. Get in touch with us and we'll talk to you about it. On the new hate speech legislation, does that apply to everyone? Can I, as an individual, take someone to court if they are hateful or derogatory towards me? Or is it just for the likes of Gardaí or people in power? Well, that's an interesting question. The hate can be directed at anyone. It will be prescribed. Individuals, groups of individuals based on gender, race, religion, what have you. You wouldn't take a case against them. It would be whether or not it was deemed criminal. Could you report them? I presume so. That's what it will allow for. Do you remember years ago when you bought petrol, you were given a handful of Green Shield stamps? You ended up with thousands of them, but you never had anything of value. Such is Sinn Féin's politics. Nothing but countless votes of no confidence in government ministers, promises to fix every problem in the country without any credible evidence of where the finance is going to come from. Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland have delivered nothing. I'm certain that if allowed into government here, things will only get worse. Mairead McGuinness called them out correctly when she told Mary Lou McDonald that Sinn Féin are what they're really about. Well, I mean, obviously, the political situation in Northern Ireland is different in that it's centrally funded, isn't it, from London. There's two parties there. There's no government there. Sinn Féin did produce, now you can discredit it or disagree with it, but they did produce an alternative budget, which is costed. And within that, they've had to not only cost what they're promising, but also to state how they would raise those funds. So to say that they don't have any credible evidence to suggest how they would do things, they would point to their alternative budget and say, this is what we are going to achieve. This is how we're going to do it. Now, look at, in terms of taxing the rich, big businesses, foreign direct investment here have concerns about that. They say that it could discourage people coming here to work. And, you know, that can be all teased out and argued, I presume, in the run-up to election. But they would argue, as I say, that they have costed and funded what they are committing. But they haven't been in power. So how can you judge them until such time as they have been in power either at the same time down here? Morning, Greg. Please ask Piers Doherty, will his party cap the number of foreigners coming into Ireland if his party gets to run the country? Thank you. I kind of asked that question. I note Piers Doherty referring to Dublin rioters as criminals. While I feel that rioting and looting is wrong, it's worth noting that Piers did not describe Black Lives Matter rioters in the US as criminals and thugs, though I didn't put that to him. In fact, they 100% supported the group and described anyone who objected as right-wing racists. It's also interesting that he agrees with facial recognition and hate speech laws. They're now similar to the government parties. Elements of the hate speech law they did contest in the Shannon. I just think it's, how do I describe this or say this? We are very careful in the language that we choose sometimes, and then other times, like, it's not, I don't think it's good, personally speaking, for the Gardaí or politicians to refer to people as thugs or scumbags. Scumbags is a phrase I absolutely like, and then to be very careful with the language being used in other cases, if that makes sense. So, you know, you call one group of people thugs and scumbags, and then you're incredibly careful with how you might describe another individual or group of people. I think that's a slippery slope. I think it's a bit of a race to the bottom, and I think language is important in the wider scale of things, or at least it should be equal. Why can the Garda age limit not be 45 instead of 35? Well, it was increased, or it's proposed to be increased. I believe that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil should all go. This government is a joke at running the country because nothing but hassle. People turning on people because of their actions. No words on the children that were injured last week. Just another victim. Nothing to see here. When that happened, you give an excuse to people that want to cause havoc. It would be interesting to see if people locally and nationally have made large sums of money by accommodation purposes off refugees. Well, I think you know the answer to that question yourself. Look, in terms of what you can say about a perpetrator of a crime, whatever the crime may be, until that person is charged, you cannot talk about that person on these platforms. You simply can't. The Gardaí can't reveal his name even until such time as he's charged, until such time a person, sorry, is charged or able to be charged, because that then is used as a defence in any court case. How could anyone get a fair trial when they were named and so much information was given about them before they were even charged or as they were charged? So that is perfectly normal. Once a person is charged of the most heinous of crimes, you will hear nothing of that case, of that person again, until it goes to court, because it's illegal to do so, and that could compromise the case. That's the case no matter whether from, what it's about, how bad the crime is. Once they're charged here, you cannot talk about it again until the case begins, and you certainly couldn't talk about other stuff until the case is concluded. As it relates to victims or somebody who's injured, I can't ring Letterkenny University Hospital and say, how's so-and-so getting on? Do you know, say, for instance, someone was injured in a road traffic collision. You can't just ring up. We have no right to that information. That's a private individual, and it's a matter for their family. So you cannot then give daily updates on someone's condition. It will come from time to time if it is released, if it's deemed that they can get the information that can be released. Again, I'm not defending any system, by the way. I'm just outlining it. So the reason you're not hearing any update is because there's no update available. We can't ring a hospital and say, how's such and such a person getting on? And the reason you don't hear anything then about perpetrators or alleged perpetrators is because of the legal court system. Whether you believe that should be changed or not, that's completely up to you, but that's just the situation as it stands. Would Pearse Doherty agree Helen McEntee opened the gates for migrants as a result of this country? Are unable to cope with them? All the Gardaí can't handle all of them. That's why there's so many guards off on sick leave. I mean, if you look at the general profile of the riots on Thursday, it wasn't immigrants or migrants. There certainly was some involved, or they could have been born here. I don't know. You can't judge where someone's from purely off the colour of the skin. But, I mean, if you look at the makeup of the rioters, I don't think you could say that Helen McEntee opened the floodgates, let all these migrants in, and then they rang amok. I'm a Sinn Féin supporter. I would like to know, are Sinn Féin backing this new hate legislation? Well, you heard they had issues with some of it. Now, as we mentioned on this programme before, a public meeting on the future of Letterkenny University Hospital is taking place tonight. It's in the Mount Herigal Hotel Letterkenny at 8 p.m. The objectives of the event, we're told, is to allow the community, patients and the staff of the hospital to have a forum to collectively express their experiences of using Letterkenny University Hospital. Mary T. Sweeney is chair of the Letterkenny Hospital Campaign Group and joins us on the programme now, Mary T. So we're going to be speaking to one of those who will be speaking at the event this evening. But just to outline why you believe it's important as many people who can attend do attend.
Well, the reality is it's a hospital for all of us, and it's so important that we show that we support the staff of the hospital, but they need additional resources, additional finances, and they need a review of the structure of the hospital to really, from the stories we hear, to have the best service that they can give the people of Donegal. And at the moment, we're not getting the best service for the people of Donegal. We're getting a compromised service.
I beg your pardon. Do you believe, too, that you know much of tonight really is going to echo the concerns of GPs and consultants, but come at it from the perspective of the patient, or perhaps maybe the, you know, the rank and file staff, so to speak?
Well, what I really believe is that it's disingenuous for the minister to say he's going to do a review of the hospital and the facilities and structure, and without speaking to the consumer, the patient. It'll be an incomplete report or review if you don't speak to the patients, the people of Donegal, who are the end users of the hospital. And we need the best. And it's not personal to me. It's for all of us and for the generations coming behind us. If we don't look after our hospital and not fight, but campaign strongly to get additional resources, who's going to do it? Somebody has to kick the ball here and start this off. And I'm delighted we did in January. The doctors have come on board and the consultants, and I spoke to two of them last night. And really, I think everybody recognises that a unified voice would be the best way forward here. And this is the first time that I'm aware of that multiple groups are being brought together in the one campus. We have speakers for several of the advocacy groups. And if anybody hasn't heard about it and is just hearing now for the first time, my number's out there. I'm sure they can get it through you, or Donna's number's in the literature that went out last night. Contact any of us, though, and we will accommodate you tonight, because we need to bring all these collective groups together where possible to have a unified voice to represent the people of Donegal to get a better service.
It is
ultimately support.
Yeah, it is about the people and the service users, but of course politicians have a role to play in this. Have various political personalities or whatever you might representatives been invited? Are they partaking in this? Do you know?
All of them are invited. I had a Donna looks after that. In fairness, that's the right. Emails, the majority of them. I have had acceptances from some and apologies from several that had previous commitments for meetings tonight. But when there's political parties, there's multiple. I presume there'll be at least one from all of the mainstream. I presume that, but from the feedback, I haven't looked at it myself. I've been that busy this last couple of days. But Donna has had acceptances and has had apologies. But I do know that there are people coming tonight, yes. And I presume all political parties will be represented. They do attend normally.
Yeah, Bernie's with us. Bernie, you've decided that you're going to speak at this event tonight. What story are you going to tell, Bernie?
I had a 15-year-old French student stand with myself during the summer. She was on a foreign exchange trip, and my three children had developed a chickenpox while she was here. So during the course of them having their chickenpox, I noticed Mano was was becoming sick herself. And throughout the time, she was it was pretty obvious that she was perhaps experiencing viral meningitis. So I had to try and locate a doctor, which was hard, first of all, to get a GP for her because she was from France. Upon going to the GP, he automatically sent her to the hospital. Her symptoms were quite severe. You know, she was having neck pain, extreme headaches, extreme sensitivity to light and muscular weaknesses. So upon getting to the hospital, she was triaged very fast, I have to say, because of her symptoms. However, when we went through, she was put into a bed where they were trying to monitor and take the best course of action. Within the hour, she had to leave that bed because an elderly lady came in with RSV and they were worried about that passing over. So this resulted in Mano then sitting in a chair in A&E for 18 hours with those severe symptoms that she was expressing. So during that course of time, she was a paediatric consultant come down, and we were told that, you know, she was being admitted to PEDS. So we waited for 18 hours to get to PEDS. At 10 o'clock the next morning, the coordinator of the exchange group actually ran through to paediatrics to see what the situation was. And paediatrics expressed to her, I don't know why this woman has been told this. We have got no beds for that child. So that's another problem. You know, this hospital is serving 250,000 people and they've only got less than 25 beds in the pediatric ward. Crazy. Scary. I had been in touch with Mano's mum, and she wanted, you know, she wasn't happy with the care that her daughter was getting. Mano was very distressed and a lot of pain, and we decided, you know what, we're just going to take her home. Upon this, I was asked to sign a waiver to say that I was taking her home against medical advice, which I refused to do so because I said I haven't been given any medical advice or medical care for this child. So I'm not signing a document to say that I have. So they then sent a consultant to look at her after I had refused to sign that. and the consultant said that he did feel that it was viral, but unfortunately with the provision in the hospital that it would be best if I took her home and monitored her myself. You know, I've got no medical experience. I was taking this 15-year-old with suspected viral meningitis home to monitor her myself because the hospital didn't have the provision to do that. So I did take her home and things didn't get any better. She started losing the power of her legs and we had to return to hospital. Now, this time when we returned to hospital, they did allow us to skip A&E and we got directly through to the pediatric ward, which was great. They did discover swelling on her brain. Keeping in mind, I had just been sent home 2 days prior to just monitor this child. They did discover swelling on her brain and decided that an MRI and a lumbar puncture would need to take place. Her mom flew over from France. Now, her parents, both of her parents, are doctors themselves in France, in the hospitals in France. So the mother came over where we had to wait another couple of days just for the provision of the MRI machine. You know, where she's taken up a bed because the MRI machine wasn't available for her to use on day one. So she had her MRI, she had her lumbar puncture, and they confirmed that this was viral meningitis. They felt by this point that she was probably over the worst of it. So again, we did get to go home. Now, there were complications with that lumbar puncture, and upon arriving home, Mino could not... even leaving the hospital, she could not stand up, she couldn't walk, she couldn't sit, she couldn't even lean up to eat. So at this stage, her parents felt it would be best to try and get her back to France for further medical intervention. They'd kind of lost, you know, the faith in our medical system. So to get her back to France, there was going to need to be a medical helicopter where she could lie down. Now, in order to get approved for this, we had to get it signed off by a doctor. The GPs refused to do that, and the consultant from the hospital wouldn't do that over the phone. So Mano had to go back to hospital for a third time. Now, this time, because of her condition had worsened, she had to get an ambulance back to the hospital because she could not sit up. Upon arriving in the hospital, she had to go through A&E again. Now, when she came in, she was on a trolley from the paramedics, with the paramedics, and that paramedic had to sit with Mano for over an hour until a handover was able to be done. Now, that is a paramedic and an ambulance off of our road. And he said that this is protocol. I spoke to him about it. He had said that the previous week he had to wait for over 10 hours to do a handover. Mm-hmm. And that is scary to think, for 10 hours for such an important service to be held up.
And did she manage to get transferred to France in the end then?
So whenever we went through to A&E there and they finally did do the handover, they took the trolley from her and there was nowhere for her, no beds, no seats. We had to make a bed on the floor for her. She finally did get seen eventually and was kept overnight again until they would sign her off. So they did sign her off to get that medical flight back to France. But when she came back to my house, her mother stayed for a further week and she started to show slight improvements. So mm-hmm. we decided to hold off on the medical flight. And slowly and over time, Mano did make a full recovery.
Wow, okay.
Now, I spoke to her mother. I actually spoke to her mother last night, just, you know, to get consent to tell Mano's story too. And to ask her about what she felt. You know, she's a doctor over in France, and how did she feel? She felt that our doctors were excellent. You know, this is not an attack on any member of staff in that hospital. They do their best. I was talking to one doctor and he had been working for 36 hours straight. Now, that's also scary. These, you know, 36 hours straight, how are you going to perform to the best of your mm-hmm. ability? But what she did bring up was that she felt that confidentiality was a big thing. And I do get what she means there. We're separated by little curtains. I learned so much information from other patients in that hospital.
Yeah.
Information that I should not be privy to. Mental health information.
I've heard horror stories in relation to that. People being asked really personal questions like... I was talking to a woman on this program well into her 60s, asked her when was the last time she had sex or when was the last time she had a period. And you know, when that's yeah. or when the last time she went to the toilet, you hear these. And that's the stuff we probably should be able to sort out. And we did get a commitment from hospital management, that things like that would be sorted. But Bernie, listen, thank you for your time. People can hear more from you. I do appreciate you sharing that story with us. Mary T. Sweeney, the health minister says he wanted to come up and debunk all the bad mouth thing about the hospital. Do you know what I mean? That we're talking it down, maybe even discouraging people from attending it. Is Bernie's experience typical? Are we over-amplifying a handful of cases, or are cases like Bernie's typical and that's why we have to talk about it?
Well, I think the reality is, Greg, we're in a very slippery slope. The government minister in charge of our hospital is saying that he's doing a review, which to me is an internal review by sending down staff. That's not going to talk to the patients, the end users. Then it is not a comprehensive review.
Well, one GP last week said we can't have a situation where the HSE is marking its own homework.
That's exactly what it is. And while we were promised after our first campaign in January that there was, the word came out then that there would be a Scottish team coming over to do an independent review, I would actually like to up the ante now and say, what about a French team? The French have an excellent standard of health service. We should have somebody completely independent coming in here. Okay. We have to participate in this current review. The stories that we collect tonight, we're asking people to bring their written accounts. Many people are looking for us to write them. We can't do that. We don't have the team to do that. But have your written story brought along. It could be handwritten. We'll type it up for you. And give us permission that we hand these to the minister. These are going to identify some of the reality of facing our elderly communities, our parents, our children. And we need to get these documents.
Okay, Mary
T. People can say, this needs fixed, this needs fixed. This is the reality from the patient perspective.
Right.
Even things like the elderly contacting me about the chairs, asking one man sitting 20 hours in the chair with spinal problems.
The chairs, we talked about the chairs. We were told cushions were coming and then the cushions disappeared. How much were they? Where did they go? And to be honest with you, that's listed out as if, as if a shoulder shrugging exercise. That's important. Where did these covers go? How much did they cost? How long were they there? Did anyone ever sit in one? Where did they go? You know what I mean? It's crazy, and yet it's almost a throwaway situation, but it's not. We were told that people would have more privacy in giving their information in the ED, more privacy in speaking about their medical matters. These aren't the big problems, but these are the things that would help make things a bit easier. This is what I was talking about when we're trying to help, not to, we thought we were getting progress there, but clearly not. But there's going to be an awful lot of information at the public meeting tonight. Everyone is invited. It's apolitical. It's on the future of Letterkenny University Hospital. It's at the Mount Errigal Hotel, Letterkenny, at 8 p.m. tonight. We might check back with you just to get an update on it, Mary T, if that's okay.
Can I say thank you, Greg, to yourself and to Caroline, because we do not have the facilities, the money. We did put a few posters up last night just to remind people it's on tonight. But again, as people appreciate, I have to thank the papers. I have to online and in print who helped us, because we have not had the money to put into this campaign that we would have obviously liked to have had done. It's limited resources from a team of people that I've got to know. And anybody that feels they have a quality of experience that they want to come on board, I'm delighted that Dr. O'Rourke's coming on board. Unfortunately, won't be able to make it tonight. Some of the GPs from the service contacted me yesterday. They're delighted at what we're doing. They recognise this is needed.
Understood.
And they are all equally welcome that can come along.
Okay.
And apologies if we didn't reach out individually to people, but it's a lot that we're trying to do.
Okay, I get you. Mary T. Sweeney, thank you very much for your time. Now we want to say a good morning and a big congratulations to Paul Lynch, who won the 2023 Booker Prize for his novel Prophet Song, becoming the sixth Irish author to win this most influential English language fiction prize since it began back in 1969. Congratulations, Paul.
Thanks, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Has it begun to sunk in a little bit? Because obviously, you've been going through the writing process, publishing, being shortlisted, winning national prizes, and then all the press that follows. I mean, has it also sunk in for you?
I'm not sure fully that it has. I mean, when you win a prize like the Booker, you're sort of immediately just picked up by the whirlwind and spun around. And so I've been in the publicity tunnel now since Monday morning, about 7:30. I've done about, I think, over 40 interviews with global and Irish media. and I do not know myself at this point. But it's all, you know, it's the kind of thing where you say, okay, this is probably never going to happen again. Mm. And so I'm enjoying it as well.
But do you feel to some extent, Paul, you've been dragged from your life into another life in that, you know, you've got quite a few commitments as part of this prize as well. Obviously, you get the financial reward, but obviously other commitments that have to be fulfilled over the time ahead. You probably just want to sit down and write. Like, is that something you're processing too?
Yeah, I mean, I've been told, and I knew in advance, that if you win the Booker, there's not much writing done for the next year. That's just the reality of it. Because, as you say, there are a lot of commitments. I mean, I met my agent yesterday. We had a meeting about how we're just going to get our heads around all this. And he was meeting with another agent who had, Eleanor Catton's agent, who had, because it's a steep learning curve for everyone. And, he said, I'm afraid to show you my inbox because it's crazy, just invitations from all over the world. This is my new life now. But I think there's a responsibility that's worth meeting. I think that when you become a writer, become a Booker winner, that you have a cultural position too within Ireland. I'm happy to be that person now, because it's an honor.
Just in relation to the book Prophet Song, it explores the rise of political extremism and the plight of refugees. Now, obviously, on the face of it, people think, wow, that's political. Is this, art imitating life, life imitating art? But you're, I wouldn't say you're at pains to, or maybe you are, to point out that this is not, you're not a political novelist as such, that this is about something else, maybe in this sort of a landscape. Is that something that you feel very important to get across to people, or are you open for people to interpret as they see fit?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I say this is because when the book is presented, it sounds like I'm, that it's a sort of one-dimensional political book that's hacking away at a grievance. And that's not what this book's about at all. This book has multiple lenses. It's complex. And, the book is really much more philosophical in its ideas than it is political. And I'm really more interested in ideas of life and death and power and powerlessness and how we try to make sense of our lives within, with what we find ourselves being thrown around by these enormous forces that shape the world that we're in. And so the character, Eilish Stack, the center of the novel, she's a mother of four. She's three teenagers among them. She's got a husband who works for the Teachers Union of Ireland who's arrested and disappeared. And her dad is he's retired, but he's sliding into dementia, and she's got a career and trying to hold that down while Ireland in the book is beginning to just slide into tyranny and chaos. And I'm interested in that sense of trying to sort of navigate the labyrinth when you cannot see what's ahead and making decisions, but those decisions becoming, those decisions being the wrong decisions rather than the right ones.
Born in Limerick, you grew up in Malinhead, now you're based in Dublin. I'm looking for a local angle here, Paul, help me out. How did your time up here form you as an artist, as a novelist, I wonder?
I mean, I'm a Donegal man because I was 9 months old when I came to Donegal and I left it when I went to college, so my entire childhood, any awareness of a childhood is Donegal, And I moved to Malinhead when I was 9 months. We lived there till I was five, and then we moved to Carndonagh. I lived in Carndonagh until I was 18. And, there's something that the place did that I didn't realize what it was doing until I'd left it. Many years later, when I was writing, it's just the sort of the elemental imprint of the place on your psyche. When I think of Malinhead now, and I have a feeling from my childhood as a really young kid of just that rawness of the sea air, the sound of the wind. I mean, I remember the sound of the wind, and that's not something you get in Dublin, for example, or Limerick or anywhere like that. And later when I lived in Carn, you would turn right from our house and you would walk into the town, but you would turn left and you would go up into the bogland. And there's something about that sort of timelessness that you take for granted when you live there, but really it's an extraordinary landscape. And I've taken people up to Donegal to see it, and I remember taking a French TV crew, and it was a really tricky day because they were way behind on time, and the producer was saying, we don't have time to get this far, we'll just stop and do the interview in a pub in Buncrana. And I said, no, we're going to keep going a few miles further out the road. And we did. I will never forget the gasp. They'd never seen anywhere like it.
Wow.
And we did an interview just, on that stretch of road between Buncrana and Carn, and it was magic. And there's just something about that. And I used it in my writing. I let that sort of timelessness, that sort of mythic feel about the place work its way into my fiction.
All right, you've done 40 local, national, international interviews, but I'm going to give you something that you can't get even on CNN. Paul Lynch and I used to go to clarinet lessons at Carn School. It's mind-blowing that he's now a Booker Prize winner. If you remember, can you pass on huge congratulations from me, his clarinet buddy, Lorna? Okay.
Oh, Lorna. Oh, my gosh. My God.
And the Kelly family in Churchtown want to wish you well as well. But as I say, you can only get that from your local radio station, Paul.
Hi to everybody. Hi, hello to everyone.
All right. God bless you, Paul. Continued success. And listen, it's wonderful for you and Donegal and the country as a whole. Congratulations and thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care of yourself. Our next guest up, actually, another person who's making waves locally, nationally and internationally. Eric Roberts is in studio with me after these. We're joined in studio by content creator from Donegal, of course, Eric Roberts. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. And sorry for holding you up a little bit there. We do appreciate your time. How are you keeping?
I'm absolutely fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Listen, and congratulations on your career. Because you took a chance, didn't you, Eric? You threw yourself into this 100% and you're really reaping the rewards. And it's fantastic to see a local person doing so well.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an incredible year. It's filled with opportunities that I didn't really expect, to be honest, when I did step away from work. But I was busy enough online that decision was sort of made for me. And I've just been really enjoying the process since. Now, to be fair, I didn't think it was going to go as well as it has, so I'm terrified I might have peaked a bit early. So hopefully I continue to keep getting these kind of opportunities.
What has that highlight for you been so far?
This year as a whole has just been insane. I got to travel 4 continents with work, and I got married. Obviously now, more recently, I'm on the biggest show on Netflix and globally, so it's been a whirlwind of a year, but as I say, I've just been really, really enjoying the process.
Yeah, and we're talking about your participation in Netflix's new reality series Squid Game, The Challenge. I mean, everyone knows Squid Game, everyone watched it. Was that during lockdown? But anyway, everyone watched it one way or other, and this is a real life version of it. And you join 455 contestants battling out to snag the life-changing prize of almost $5 million. And even to get down to that 455, a massive, massive achievement.
Yeah, I think there was around 100,000 applicants, and over about a six-month period, they whittled that down to the 456. And I was one of the lucky ones they selected, and we flew over to London in January of this year, and we were put through a couple of weeks of absolute torture. And what you're watching back now is the producer of that.
What can you say about it in terms of what's been out, your role in it and that type of stuff?
Well, there's been 9 episodes now aired. Last week, I got through the first 5 and I didn't have much luck in there. I got the umbrella shape, which was the most difficult shape. I managed to get past that. I actually crossed the line 2nd in red light, green light as well. In terms of airtime, I didn't get a whole pile. I think just because my game plan in there was to keep my head down. I didn't really want to be one of the loudest in the room and getting much camera time, because those were the people that were being eliminated. So that was the game plan from early on. Now, if anyone's, I won't give away any spoilers, but if anyone has been watching this latest batch of episodes, we'll just say it didn't go my way again.
You say I'm disadvantaged because I like to binge stuff when it's all out.
Yeah.
I've just been conditioned to that now, thanks to the likes of Netflix and all. Where was it shot?
It was filmed in London in January.
Okay, and did it feel like competition or did it feel like a show or a mixture of both?
It was totally immersive.
Yeah.
And when I say that, we were starved, we were sleep deprived. We were really, really put through our paces for a couple of weeks. It was mentally and physically one of the most challenging things I've ever had to do. So it wasn't produced in any way, shape or form. It was a huge cast with 200 cameras in a huge dormitory, 200 of us sleeping in the one room. And that number was just whittled down over time. And as the weeks progressed, it just got worse and worse. You didn't know who your friends were. You didn't know who to trust. So we were really put through our paces. Do you know what I mean? This wasn't a glamorous affair at all. And yeah.
So it's a psychological element, then the physical element and the gaming element.
Yeah.
You all had to deal with that indeed. And what an achievement to finish 2nd in the red light, green light challenge, which you've been revealing a bit of behind the scenes stuff on your socials. That took a long time to get through.
So that particular game, depending on where you finished. Obviously, I came across the line second. It took me around 6 hours to get over the line. So what they don't show you on TV is when we froze in a static position, we had to stay in that position for 40 minutes at a time. People's legs were seizing up, people were fainting, collapsing. If you needed to go to the bathroom, you just had to make a decision there and then. Do you know what I mean? So that was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. And I've gone through pre-seasons with SP Barrett there from Milford, so like I know what I'm talking about. Do you know what I mean? This was extremely tough. But I did well to get over the line when I did. Some people were standing out there for 8 or 9 hours. Do you know what I mean? So it was an incredibly difficult thing.
So what does the future hold for you, Eric? I mean, your life feels at the moment that you could get the biggest opportunity of your life tomorrow, or you could wait 6 months, or it may never come, but we hope it will, and I'm sure it will. Is it exciting? Is it chaotic? Is it what? How do you...
I mean, it's extremely exciting. It's, as I say, the opportunities that came my way this year, I never dreamt of, and I'm hoping that continues coming into the new year. But I think I have a more solid vision of where I want to go this year as opposed to last year. I kind of tried as much as I could this year with regards to acting or comedy or presenting, and I absolutely adore presenting. I have my own slot now in Ireland AM, and I'm hoping to get a more regular slot maybe on TV or radio coming into the new year. Because I think that's where I see myself going, maybe.
And you know, but we need someone to back you. And even the likes of an RTE. And not just back you, but back the amazing, other amazing talent that we have around the country. Because it can be hard to get in, can't it, Eric? You know what I mean? And you're putting yourself out there. You've got a huge profile. But even someone in your position, sometimes it can just be hard to get in.
Yeah, well, it's just about getting the foot in the door and grabbing the opportunity when it arises. And as I say, I had a couple of interviews earlier in the year with Virgin Media, and after those, they offered me a slot. So I think the more you do, the more you put yourself out there, the more opportunities you're going to get. So I'm just going to continue to do that.
Do you get much time for yourself?
Not lately, no, but I think I'm on the treadmill now, so I just have to keep running until it stops, basically. I'm working very, very hard. But I'm doing that because who knows how long is this going to last. So I just want to really strike while the iron's hot now and keep working as hard as I'm working. But I'm enjoying the process as well.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time too, in terms of your profile and your presence, you know, it's not like you've just gone viral for one reason either. I mean, you've gone into this with a plan. Do you know what I mean? It's far more nuanced than that. You are more broadly established, and that's important, isn't it? You don't want to be a... You know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have an online persona, so I'm very much myself. So I'm not struggling to put up content because I'm just putting up my day to day. I'm very transparent with family life and just the disaster that is me from time to time, and people seem to enjoy watching that. So I'm not struggling for ideas per se, but I think it resonates with everyone that everyone realizes how lucky I am and the position that I'm in, and I'm so grateful for it. So I'm going to just continue to remain as that, and I think people are along for the ride with me, and who knows what's going to happen next, and that's exciting.
Anything big coming up that you can reveal to us or anything like that?
I've an exciting start to January, I'll say that, and all will be revealed.
All right, brilliant stuff. Well, Eric, listen, thanks so much for calling down. We do really appreciate it. It's great to see where you're going with your career and everything. We look forward to seeing how it unfolds. You do get time to spend at home too. You have to try and balance that up.
I've booked a couple of weeks off now for Christmas, yeah, so I'll be putting the feet up.
And Brendan Devaney last Friday was talking about you playing football. Are you actually on the panel for Downing's?
I was on the panel. I think I played about 10 minutes of senior football this year just because I've been away so much, but hopefully I'll be around a bit more last year.
Well, that does mean you have a little fingerprint on the, you know, breaking that 30-year wait. Okay,
absolutely.
Brilliant stuff. All right, Eric, listen, thank you so very, very much indeed. That's Eric Roberts, a content influencer from Donegal, of course, and his career going from strength to strength, and it's great to see. Eric, thanks so much.
Cheers, guys.